My name is Ed Goldberg. Welcome to Author Author, an occasional series of conversations with authors touring through Portland or whom I have reached by phone. My name is Ed Goldberg, and I have the pleasure of speaking with Sean Levy. Sean, welcome to All Classical.
Thank you.
Title of your latest book is De Niro, A Life, and it's published by Crown Archetype. Now, full disclosure, you and I have known each other, what, 10, 15 years easily?
20-ish.
You think?
Yeah, okay.
I think so. And you at one time were the major film critic for The Oregonian, which is how I met you. And now you're working for KGW-TV here in Portland.
Yeah, I do movie reviews 2-3 times a month on Sunday mornings. I can be a little more selective with what I review. I tend to only say nice things on the air. Wasn't always the case in print.
Uh-huh. Yeah, what a bunch of junk. You don't do that anymore.
Well, I was reviewing 250, 300 movies a year, and now I'm reviewing 25, 30.
Yeah, that's really a lot better, isn't it?
It's much more pleasant, yeah.
Okay. A couple of things about this book, clearly about Robert De Niro, but there's two things. I've read almost all of your books. I think I missed the Porfirio Rubirosa book. And I've always been impressed with your attention to reportage. You know, you do the good reporting. You get the facts. In this case, you've amassed a huge amount of facts. This is a big, fat book. But the other thing about this is that the quality of your critical analysis, I think, is better than it's ever been. Looking at your analysis of his work, of his acting, things like that, the films that he made. And I said, yeah, you know, if you want to know something about what a movie critic, a film critic, looks at, this is a good way to find out because you do it.
Well, thanks. I was aware when I was writing this book that there was another De Niro book in the works. Glenn Kenny did a book, a very, very fine critic who used to be at Premiere Magazine, part of a Cahiers du Cinéma series called Anatomy of an Actor. So I think it kind of focused a little more, like a Sunday golfer suddenly in a competitive match. I think both of us upped our game. I think Glenn's book is it's a different sort of project entirely. It's more academic, perhaps, mm-hmm. or more analytical purely. It's not a biography, but I think we both benefited from knowing that the other guy was out there.
Now, there is a plethora of detail in this book, and it would be ridiculous for me to try to go through the whole book, but there are some things. I want to start past the middle, even. There was a film called The Score.
Mm.
You know the film I'm talking about. And I went to see this film knowing that I was set up for a disappointment, that it couldn't possibly meet my expectations. And in Marlon Brando, who I worshipped as a child, I saw him in The Wild One when I was 12 years old, and I fell in love with him. It was like a boy crush on Brando. There's De Niro, and there's Edward Norton, who can be considered Brando's artistic, spiritual heirs in some way, even though their acting styles are not that similar. The two things I came away with from that film is that even though Brando was old and fat and way below his normal game, every scene that he was in, I couldn't take my eyes off him. And the other thing was that the movie sucked. Would you like to expound on that?
You know, Brando is one of those guys. It's sort of like when Willie Mays came to bat, you stopped what you were doing and watched.
Exactly.
Or Tiger Woods is putting, you watch. He was so great and so revolutionary. Everything we understand about method acting, the American method, as opposed to the Russian method, which was misinterpreted or selectively interpreted by American practitioners, what we think of as method acting, you could just say it's what Marlon Brando does, or at least did in the first 25 or so years of his career. And De Niro is a huge heir to it. You know, De Niro has two Oscars. One for Godfather Part II, one for Raging Bull. In each of those roles, he specifically quotes a line of Marlon Brando's knowingly. The audience knew it, he knew it. So his career, in a certain sense, is built on Brando's career. De Niro's breakthrough, and the breakthrough of the method actors of his generation, which includes Al Pacino, Dustin Hoffman, Rod Steiger. He's a little earlier, but he overlaps.
He was in On the Waterfront with...
He's on the waterfront, but then he's acting, regularly acting well after Brando has given up or is only doing selective films to pay for additions to his Tahitian domain. De Niro's generation leveled out the playing field so that everyone who follows them is a method actor. You don't have anyone learning acting in America or very many in the UK or the European continent who don't practice something like the Stanislavskian method as interpreted by Lee Strasberg and or Stella Adler.
Yeah.
So, you know, it is a generational film, but it's not a very satisfying film. The script was, you know, one of these Hollywood caper movies that got tamped on by six teams of writers. Edward Norton had a stab at the script. Brando feuded with the director, Frank Oz, to the point where Brando refused to work if Oz was on the set. So he worked through
video
and an earpiece. And De Niro directed Brando in the last few scenes they shot together. Brando refused to wear pants so that he would only be shot from the belly up, you know, and had profane outbursts at Frank Oz that were reported in Time magazine. I mean, this wasn't like scuttlebutt. This was a bona fide news source. So it was disastrous despite all the hope. And yet there are moments, you know, there are moments that you can't help but enjoy.
I wonder what Brando would have been like if he didn't have the outlet of acting. He probably would have been a world-class psychopath. I mean,
yeah, I'm not sure he wasn't. you know, Peter Manso's biography of Brando is you know, kind of like a rap sheet. It's really awful.
Mm-hmm. De Niro was a New York City kid, a Greenwich Village kid. His parents, I think that he got a lot of his work ethic, and he has a very strong work ethic, from his parents. His father was a painter, and his mother an academic. Great name, Virginia Military. Virginia Admiral. So I was going to say it sounds like a military academy, and I fused the two. Virginia Admiral, what a fantastic name. The immediate effect on De Niro from his parents was not that great because he was a street kid and he didn't do that well in school, whereas both his parents were of the greatest generation. They had that kind of an attitude about everything. Can you talk a little bit about that?
His dad was a remarkable talent. As a young man, Robert De Niro Sr., he was Robert Mario. The son is Robert Anthony. The father had his first solo exhibition of paintings at the age of 24 at the Art of This Century Gallery on 57th Street, which was a hugely important venue for abstract expressionism after World War II. He has been collected in major museums all over the world. He passed in 1993. In the 20-odd years since then, his reputation has only burnished in the classic way of the artist who was underappreciated in his day. He painted in a very specific style, and his peers, and they literally were chums, Willem de Kooning, Franz Klein, Jackson Pollock, they all went on to great fame, glory, and wealth. De Niro Sr. stuck to his original métier, and he was very hard on himself. He never changed his style, but he was very hard on what he considered a finished work. And there are accounts of him tearing up canvas after canvas of a set piece that he was trying to depict until he got what he wanted. And I think the son saw that. The mother was a scrapper. She was a painter and a poet. She was a businesswoman. She was a landlord. She was a key figure in the development of Lower Manhattan as an art colony. She bought up warehouse spaces and machine shop spaces and converted them into artist lofts for their friends. The father never had very much money, but he always had a free place to live because his ex-wife would give him one of her lofts as a home. And I think the combination of things, being true to your art and being very hard on yourself until you get it right and being savvy in business, those two examples stuck with De Niro. He didn't become a businessman until he was almost in his 50s, but he was always very demanding of himself as a film artist.
Mm-hmm. He didn't go there long, as you told me, but there was a school in the Greenwich Village called the Little Red Schoolhouse. Among the same people who were there at the same time that De Niro was were Mary Travers from Peter, Paul, and Mary, John Sebastian, the son of the harmonica player John Sebastian, who started Love and Spoonful, a great folk and rock and roll musician. This was a remarkable crucible for a lot of talent in the village.
You know, it's funny. We think of De Niro as this Italian-American street kid, and really he wasn't. He grew up, you know, maybe 20 blocks north of Little Italy in Greenwich Village of the 40s and 50s. His parents knew Anais Nin and Tennessee Williams. I mentioned the painters that he grew up around. These people would have known him. He was kind of the only kid at the party in these bohemian settings in Greenwich Village, surrounded by poets and painters and intellectuals. His mother dated Clement Greenberg, the art critic, and Manny Farber, who later became an important film critic. And he was a loner. So if he was in school with these kids, he was at the School of Performing Arts, the FAME school, as a high schooler, but only briefly. He would have been a classmate there of James Caan, Stephen Bochco, Susan Strasberg, a lot of well-known people. He was a loner. He passed through all those circles. You know, he grew up in Greenwich Village in the 60s. He really never had a hippie phase. He never did LSD. So even when he was in the midst of things, he was kind of unto himself.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the classic outsider, which is evident, I think, from his film work as well. You know, this classic depiction of Travis Bickle, the lunatic taxi driver, in Taxi Driver, who sees the world in a way that, unfortunately, has become more and more common, I think, nowadays. You're starting to see more and more Travis Bickles running around the world. That probably came out of his guts, a character like that.
I think so. You know, he does one very interesting thing for an actor. I had access to scripts that he worked on from 1963 till 2005, and he almost always pares away his dialogue. Other actors are trying to add bits for themselves. He prefers to act with silence, with his eyes, with his body language, with his costume and props. And I think that's to do with his sense of being the outsider looking in. If you think of his Vito Corleone, he's a very quiet man, very sparing, and, you know, he looks a lot. I found in the script of Taxi Driver an amazing annotation. De Niro writes on one page, "Lonely, lonely, lonely, remember the girl you saw on 15th Street." I don't know who she was, when he saw her, what she was doing, but he had a very distinct image in his head of a person isolated. And he had an outside image of it, but I think it came from an inward place as well.
Yeah, and this is the method idea of using sense memory, an emotional memory of things that happened to you so you can invest your character with them.
Well, that's the Lee Strasberg
path,
which is outside in. De Niro studied with Stella Adler, and she was more about building from the... Strasberg was inside out, and Adler is outside in. Props, studying, you know, if you're going to play a stevedore, you go work on the docks for a week. De Niro would travel to places where his characters might come from and have people record the dialogue. Travis Bickle, this kind of nowhere man, he had the screenwriter Paul Schrader read all his dialogue into a tape recorder, and he imitated Schrader's voice. He wore Schrader's belt. He imitated Schrader's mannerisms. So he always looked for an outward thing. You know, he would spend days going through rings if he was playing a character who was married, an earring, costumes, haircuts, you know, and then he would, with that outward appearance as the foundation, he would then dive into the script and find the inward part.
Stella Adler came from a Yiddish theater family that went to Hollywood. Luther Adler was a film actor who started out in the Yiddish theater doing schmaltz, I guess,
yes,
for want of a better
literally.
Term. Yeah, literally, that's right. My favorite factoid in this book is that when he did the Godfather movies, he found a dictionary of Italian hand gestures.
Right.
And he used that to create his Vito Corleone character.
You know, he traveled to Sicily. He had people read his dialogue. His script of The Godfather 2, the script he carried to the set every day, not only did he rewrite all of his own dialogue, he rewrote the dialogue that the other Italian-speaking characters. On the day of shooting, he would be the guy on the set who knew Sicilian best. So he rewrote the lines that Bruno Kirby speaks as the young Clemenza, or the character of his wife, who only has one or two lines in the whole film. He was, you know, famous even from a very early age of being so thorough that, you know, he could be the guy, not acting as the guy, he was the guy.
Yeah. I'd like to remind my listeners that I'm talking with Sean Levy, last name spelled L-E-V-Y. The title of his book is De Niro, A Life, published by Crown Archetype. You talk about his great roles in his great movies, you know, clear like Taxi Driver and Raging Bull and The Godfather and The Deer Hunter. But you also talk about the stinkers that he did. And I found this very heartwarming that you defend his work in these films as not being necessarily bad work, but as good work in bad movies. Is that a fair characterization?
It's a fair characterization up to a certain point in time. I think through the time that his business interests became very large, he always chose...
He invented Tribeca, pretty much.
You know, Lower Manhattan, his mother had a hand in it. Yeah, there were no nice restaurants in an area of Manhattan where now, you know, the smallest apartment sells for $2 million. It was warehouses. He, you know, the Tribeca Film Center in the 1980s, when he bought it, the late 1980s, was basically an empty factory. It had been the Martinson Coffee canning and roasting factory. He bought that, turned it into something, and put a restaurant in the bottom. That's still tough to get a reservation in more than 25 years later. But he would choose projects up until about 2000, 2002, where you could say, okay, this one didn't come off, but I can see why he did it. Great Expectations, a modern update of Dickens with Ethan Hawke in the Pip role. De Niro plays the Magwitch role, the felon, the escaped convict who frightens and then helps young Pip. That film is directed by Alphonse Cuarón. So you have a fine director, an interesting concept in updating Dickens. You have films that, you know, the Kenneth Branagh update of remake of Frankenstein. Again, it's Francis Coppola producing just after he made what I think is a very good film of Dracula. Now he's trying to do the same thing with Frankenstein. Kenneth Branagh, we used to talk about him as a major director and actor,
right,
20-odd years ago.
Yeah.
So you can see, again, what De Niro did. At a certain point, though, I think he was just looking to keep working. He started making serious money on films. In 1999, he makes Analyze This, which is, you know, one of his first big hits. You know, we think of him as being in very famous milestone films, but he was never in commercial blockbuster films. And he hadn't topped the $100 million box office mark for the first almost 30 years of his career. The second film, Meet the Parents, was a global sensation. Two sequels, the Three Parents, Fockers films, have grossed almost $1.5 billion at the box office. And while that might encourage you, even more, if you're the actor, even more encouraging was the fact that he produced those films. So he's a dollar one participant in that profit stream. And I think once that started, his workaholism kept him busy, but he stopped being as selective in his material. And I don't think his work is very interesting for a long time, a decade or so.
Now, I never liked the Fockers films very much, but Analyze This was almost a revelation because he plays a mafioso who goes to a shrink, basically, Billy Crystal being the shrink. And Billy Crystal, the first time I ever saw him was when he was still in a comedy duo. So he knew how to work one-on-one with somebody in a two-man situation, which is what we have here. He played the straight man a lot of times and for De Niro. There's a wonderful give and take where the shrink says, doesn't anybody ever say no to you? And he says, yeah, but you just say, no, please, no.
Right.
Now, that line reading laid me on the floor because it was so perfect. It was attitude. It was pure New York, wise guy, snot nose. And it worked in the context of the film. And this guy could just do this. But of course, he grew up in the streets of New York. So.
Well, he's also playing off his own persona. By the time he plays Paul Vitti in Analyze This, he's played Al Capone, he's played Vito Corleone, he's played Jewish gangsters in Once Upon a Time in America and Casino.
I never bought that.
In Casino, yeah, I think.
A little
better. Not so much Once Upon a Time in America, but that movie's like the fever dream of an Italian filmmaker.
Exactly.
So the whole thing's got an air of artificiality to it. You know, it's a funny thing on this subject. In most of the films that De Niro has made with Martin Scorsese, the eight feature films, he has played either a WASP or a Jew.
Interesting.
He's only played an Italian for Scorsese a couple of times, and yet he has this reputation of, you know, making Italian-American meatball and you know, a wife beater t-shirts movies together. Not the case. He's also funny from very early in his career. His breakout role is not The Godfather or Mean Streets, by the way, very funny, Mean Streets, but it's The Gang Who Couldn't Shoot Straight, where he plays a Neapolitan bicycle racer who comes to New York, and he's a kleptomaniac. He goes into a restaurant, he steals all the mints and toothpicks. He comes, he's got one bag. By the time he's done, he's filled an apartment with coats, with furniture, with TV sets, things you don't know where he got them, but he stole them. You see, he goes into a priest's shop, pretends to be a priest from Italy, and walks out with an entire clerical outfit that he uses for further scams. he's very funny in that, very dry. Jake LaMotta's funny.
Yeah.
Travis Bickle has some funny moments.
Oh, yeah, but you're funny, right?
But you know, the actor is in command of those moments, not necessarily the character.
Talk about a commanding actor. I myself am guilty of this particular cliche about De Niro, but I know that you defend him, so I want you to do it now. Somewhere along in his career, I reviewed a film by De Niro, and I said, De Niro phoned this in. De Niro could have done this in his sleep, and it looks like he did. And that, I've heard that, and I've used that against people like Laurence Olivier, against every great actor who at some point in his career decides, I need to make a few bucks for me and my kids, and they start taking films that are maybe beneath their abilities and things like that. But, and sometimes they can't even get up enough energy to do the role well. Do you believe that De Niro started phoning in his performances?
I think that there were, you know, you can see films that he's less engaged in, starting again in the mid-90s, but particularly after about 2002. And really, you know, from 2002 till about 2011, it's hard to find a picture of him that he's in, except for maybe in a cameo role, that's any good, let alone, you know, worthy of De Niro. We have those other movies, you know, it's, you could watch the last few fights Muhammad Ali had. You could watch the last few fights Joe Louis had.
Few games that Willie Mays played.
Yeah, but wouldn't you rather watch the highlights of early in their
yes,
career?
Yes, of course.
You
yeah.
know, and that's what you remember. So, sure, we're looking at a career of you know, perhaps 100 feature films. And I would argue that 40 or 50 of them are worth seeing any day. That's an incredible percentage. You know, think of actors who had long careers, who are fine actors, Gene Hackman, Morgan Freeman. These guys worked a lot, and they made movies that were quote-unquote beneath them all the while. De Niro had, you know, 20 years where he did nothing but hit the ball off the wall, if not over the wall. You still have to pay attention when you see his name in the cast list, but I would urge people as well to look and see who directed the film, because in the past 15 years, if he hasn't had strong collaborators, he has not been strong.
You don't stint on his chaotic personal life. He had a he was a pretty strange guy. He's an outsider. He's a little off the wall sometimes. How much blowback do you think there was into his work in the times when he was struggling with ex-wives and struggling with friends and personal drug problems? How much effect do you think that had on him?
A couple of times the work suffered. New York, New York is the classic case. Both he and Martin Scorsese were overindulging in life. Both had new wives and new babies and personal entanglements beyond that. They both had substance proclivities. And the film clearly doesn't come together. But then he follows that up immediately with The Deer Hunter. So De Niro has the ability to focus given the right context. You know, he has kept a very thick line between his public and private lives.
He's really seldom in the tabloids, you know, even with his very public divorces and things like that.
Yeah, you know, well, the first divorce happened perhaps 12 years after the marriage was in effect over. He's had a couple of run-ins with the legal system. He has never been in trouble legally, but people have taken advantage of him. Or his, you know, his current wife and he had a very ugly separation and custody battle early in their marriage, which has since been resolved quite happily. Grace Hightower.
Yeah.
He has twins with a woman whom he never married, and they had the twins after their relationship was ended via in vitro fertilization.
Oh.
He had a 70th birthday party, and all of the women he's had children with, all three of them, were there. I take that as a sign that he's a right dude by the people who have been closest to him. I've written books about Frank Sinatra, Jerry Lewis, Mick Jagger. They don't have people necessarily from back in the day hanging around them anymore. De Niro has a very loyal streak. You know, I think because he was from what used to be called a broken home, he has this sense of keeping the family together. All of his children have to do with him, which is not necessarily the case with people in his station. So I think as a private man, he's you know, he's been unconventional, but he's been sort of conventionally honorable.
He has an overt loathing for the press, an aversion to the press. And you are, you know, for all intents and purposes, a media person, a reporter. Did you have any access to him?
None. I couldn't even get his people to confirm that I'd sent a request.
No kidding.
But that's okay. There's a couple of things about that. One is that you don't spend 50 years in the public eye as he has without leaving your spoor all over the place.
So to speak. Yes.
Secondly, in 2005, he donated 2 18-wheel truckloads of props, costumes, and production materials to a university archive in Texas. And I spent 6 weeks in the course of a couple of years in Austin going over everything that he donated. Letters, memos, scratch notes, scripts with his annotations on them. So in a certain sense, I had a lifelong interview with him about his work. And there were personal things mixed in through there and things that jibed with stuff I'd heard from other people or had found in other sources. In effect, I treated him the way if I was writing about Lincoln or Napoleon, as a historical figure with an archive of materials.
Yeah, you also ate in one of the 2 or 3 best barbecue cities. I know. That's a whole other story. In reading this, well, actually, this occurred to me today. I was sitting in a meeting this morning, and it suddenly, this is a big fat book. It's got a lot of detail in it. It's got a lot of facts in it. It's got a lot of opinions in it. And I wondered, is Robert De Niro describable but unknowable ultimately?
I think that's a very good way to put it. You know, there is a man there. There's a man that his children and his wives and a couple of very intimate friends know. But he's had a cloak around him since he was a boy. First as the child of bohemians, then as a kid who found this type of acting that suited his introverted nature. He could get up and express things in character that he couldn't express in a conversation. And he learned how to do that. And then, you know, once you become a star in our culture, and he's been a star since 1973, you're behind a steel curtain. And there's other stars in that area with you, but the rest of the world's on the outside. Very few people have allowed that the curtain to stay open and let their private and public lives kind of mingle. I preceded this book with a biography of Paul Newman. And he had a reputation for being hard with the press and unknowable. In fact, he was extremely open with the press. He gave literally thousands of interviews right up until his final illness. De Niro, not only doesn't he do interviews, but when he does them, he's very reticent. Interviewers wind up doing things like counting the words he speaks to them just to show how hard it is, or they transcribe all his pauses and ums and ers, almost to embarrass him for being less articulate than they'd wish he was. So he has that cloak. I think also he uses the idea that he's difficult, he's unknowable, as a mask. He can now hide behind that. Oh, you can't talk to me. I'm difficult. I'm unknowable. And he can go about his business and people don't bother trying to get to him.
What are you working on now?
I'm working on a book about Rome in the Dolce Vita era.
Oh, Renée Deckberg just died.
Yes, yes. Yeah. It's a moment in the 1950s when fashion, movies, celebrity, the high life, the yellow press, the paparazzi, all comes together in Rome, of all places, which 15 years before had been the site of not only a world war, but a civil war. You know, the Italian World War II is different from the German World War II. I think that if we look at our modern culture, popular culture, where all these sensations and gossip and big media events all collide, I think it has its seeds in this little community in Rome that flourished from like 1953 to 63. Mm-hmm. Plus, I got to go spend 3 weeks in Rome eating and doing research.
So. Yeah, it's a terrible thing.
Yeah,
the first time I went to Rome, we were on the Via Veneto because we went to that monastery at the end where they used all the bones.
The Capuchin Monastery.
And I'm walking down Via Veneto because I didn't know it was right there. And I said, this is Via Veneto. I just drove everybody else in my party nuts because I just walked up and down saying, that's where Mastroianni sat in a cafe. I'm pretty sure that's the same cafe. And everybody's going like, how long are you going to be doing this? You know.
But, you know, they rebuilt Via Veneto.
I didn't know that.
Yeah. it was so busy with the paparazzi had created such an attraction of this street, which was filled with big hotels, expensive cafes, and the American Embassy, that you couldn't shoot a film there. So Fellini rebuilt Via Veneto at Cinecittà Studios, where 3 years, and it was larger because it was easier to shoot on a bigger set than the street afforded. 3 years later, they rebuild the Roman Forum, but larger, to shoot Cleopatra. So, you know, there's all sorts of weird echoes. And there's a wonderful interview with Fellini from the time, and he says, you know, I never go to Via Veneto. It's far too crowded. Well, Guy, you created the crowd.
Yeah, it's Yogi Berra. Nobody ever goes there because it's always too crowded. It's always great to talk to you, Sean. I've been speaking with Sean Levy, who is not the film director, who spells his name exactly the same way.
Crazy.
But is our own Portland Sean Levy, film critic and author of many books, including this one, De Niro, A Life, published by Crown Archetype. You know I'm going to be reading that Rome book when you're finished.
Yeah, it shouldn't be shorter.
Okay. Thanks a lot. You've been listening to Author, Author, produced at the studios of All Classical KQAC-FM in Portland. My name is Ed Goldberg. You can find these programs at our website, allclassical.org/author. Thank you for listening, and I'll be back soon.